Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. In March 2025, I spoke to John Minnick, Assistant Professor in the Department of International Relations at LSE. His research focuses on the political economy of China's technological rise and its impact on U.S.-China relations. We spoke about why semiconductors are so important in the global economy right now, and why the U.S. is willing to go to what Dr. Minnick terms economic war over them. We also discussed how the semiconductor trade is framed as a national security issue in the U.S. and China, and how President Trump may approach the chip war in coming months. I started out by asking Dr. Minnick to outline his research and current work.
Sure. Thank you, Chris. It's really great to be here. Thanks for having me. My name is John Minnick. I am an assistant professor of international political economy in the International Relations Department here at the LSE. I joined the department in September. Prior to that, I was a postdoctoral fellow at Columbia University and a research fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. And prior to that, I finished my PhD in political science at MIT. My research interests broadly are focused on the political economy of China's economic and technological rise. And I look at, I would say, both sides of the equation in the sense that one bucket of my research is really thinking about the origins of and the causes behind China's economic rise. And the other bucket is trying to tease out some of the consequences and implications of China's economic and technological rise. So the first portion of my research is primarily focused on technology transfer. This is the subject of my dissertation, which is in the process of becoming my first book project. That is really thinking about a set of tools that China used in the 1990s, in the early 2000s, and through the 2010s to try to secure transfers of technology from foreign firms that were investing in China, thinking about the political economy of China's use of those tools and the bargaining dynamics between Chinese authorities and foreign multinational corporations investing in China. And the second bucket of my research is focused on really U.S.-China technological competition in a variety of domains. So I'm very interested in semiconductors, obviously, but also doing work on telecommunications networks, electric vehicles, and so on and so forth.
So earlier in your education, you spent time studying in China and Chinese universities. How did studying there shape your current academic interests and perspectives on U.S.-China trade and other policies?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I lived in China altogether for between 2.5 and 3 years since I first went to China in the summer of 2009. And about half of that time was spent in Chengdu in Sichuan province in southwest China, where I was studying at Sichuan University. I was studying Chinese language there. And the remainder has been split across different stints, mostly in Beijing and Shanghai, but also traveling pretty widely across China. And it's hard to overstate the impact that China has had on, obviously, my academic interests and my career path, but also my worldview more broadly. In a certain sense, I think everything I've been doing over the past 15 years since I first went to China in 2009 has been, in one way or another, chasing kind of the original high and the feeling that I got when I first landed in Shanghai in the summer of 2009. And I remember very distinctly coming off of the bus as I was entering Shanghai from Pudong International Airport. And back then, there wasn't a direct subway from the airport to downtown Shanghai, so I was on a bus. And I remember just this very palpable sense I had looking at downtown Pudong at the skyline of Shanghai, that I was in a place, I was witnessing something that was, in one way or another, going to really define the 21st century, and that I had a kind of, you know, a responsibility, but really a craving to try to understand that process as best I could. So I think everything I've been doing since then is in one way or another derivative of that first experience. So, you know, I think in terms of my academic interests, I came to those, I would say, somewhat circuitously, in the sense that in undergrad, I wasn't studying political science or international relations. I was much more interested in critical theory and comparative literature. But again, I think, you know, part of it was living in China and witnessing these really profound transformations that the country was going through, and gradually coming to realize that the in a way, the intellectual vehicle that was going to be most useful for thinking about those was not going to be the humanities, which is where I'd been before, but rather more academic international relations and political science. And really, my journey towards focusing on trade and technology-related issues is, it became clear to me at a certain point that for the foreseeable future, barring some kind of kinetic conflict between the US and China, that trade and technology would be really the center of gravity of this story going forward. So in a lot of ways, it's a sense of grounded in a sense of the fundamental importance of China's rise. And if I want to understand that process, then I need to focus on the center of gravity of that process. And so that's what I've been following.
So you recently gave a talk here at the LSE Phelan US Center on the origins of the US-China chip war. I think a lot of our listeners will have been hearing about these chips in the news recently and over time. What are these chips and why are they so important that countries will go to even what you describe as a metaphorical war over them?
Chips, semiconductors, integrated circuits, we use these terms colloquially, more or less interchangeably. And these really are the essential input into virtually every electronic device that we interact with on a daily basis, and therefore are more or less the foundation of our modern forms of life. And so, everything that we use, from our smartphones to our laptops to our household appliances to our cars, are really chock full of different kinds of chips. So the world really doesn't function without these. And what they are essentially is the electronic brains of computing. So they're the things that do the actual digital calculations that make electronics function. They store the inputs and outputs from those calculations for use in future iterations. And they translate the analog signals of the world into digital signals that can be computed on a computer and then output back out in the form of microphones and so forth. And I would say the chips that are in question in the quote unquote chip war are a very special variety or special class of these chips, which are integral to advanced large scale AI applications. So these are really, without these chips, it's impossible to train and deploy the most advanced artificial intelligence systems and various other forms of high-performance computing or supercomputing. And the reason that countries are at this point willing to go to what we call economic war over these chips is because of expectations about the potentially really revolutionary effects of artificial intelligence and other forms of high-performance computing, not only for military power and intelligence capabilities, but also for long-term economic development and productivity growth in general. And so there's a sense that the ability to access and use or to control other countries' access to and to both the chips themselves and the capacity to make them is increasingly inseparable from fundamental questions of national power and long-term economic security.
And so would it be fair to say that the US and China are sort of the two big powers in terms of making these chips and sourcing all the materials that are needed for them?
In some sense, yes. But I would say the picture is very complicated because of the highly globalized nature of semiconductor value chains. It's not just the US. It's really the US and a handful of key allies and partners, the Netherlands, Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and a handful of European countries that I would say really control much of the quote-unquote commanding heights of the global semiconductor value chain. China's also a very important player, obviously, in the global semiconductor industry, although historically China has primarily occupied what we might think of as the lower value add reaches of the semiconductor value chain. And much of the conflict over these chips right now is downstream of the Chinese government and Chinese firms' efforts over the past 15 years to dramatically shift up that global division of labor to try to capture some of the commanding heights that have been traditionally occupied by the US and its allies and partners.
So you've said that the US-China chip war is a case of limited economic warfare. What do you mean by this?
So I should say that this the presentation I gave at the Phelan Center was based on a collaborative project I'm working on with Taylor Fravel at MIT. And in the paper that that presentation was based on, we are trying to both think a little bit more systematically about how to classify the chip war as a case of something in the context of international relations theory, but also to think about the causes and downstream of that, some of the potential implications of the U.S.-China chip war. So when we characterize the chip war as a case of limited economic warfare, I mean, what we're doing first and foremost is taking, obviously, we talk about it, chip war, we use the word war colloquially in describing this conflict. But what we wanted to do is try to think a little bit more precisely about what it means to call this a form of war or a form of warfare. And so limited economic warfare, I'll take those terms individually, but in reverse order, starting with warfare. So the idea behind this is, you know, I guess we can break it up into two, sort of we can cut at this from two different dimensions. And one would be thinking about the intentions behind the U.S. semiconductor export controls on China. And the second would be thinking about the scope of the controls themselves, but also their intended or at least reasonably anticipated impact on China. So in terms of intention, I think the key distinction here is whether the semiconductor export controls are meant to somehow change China's behavior. So is the goal of these export controls to get China to, for example, improve its human rights record or change its behavior in some other way to bring it into closer alignment with the wishes of the U.S.? Or is the apparent intent of the export controls simply to degrade China's capabilities, or at least to constrain China's future progress in semiconductors? If the intent behind them is to change China's behavior, then I think it's better to characterize the export controls not as warfare, but rather as what we would call coercion. Coercion is the calibrated use of threats and assurances to try to shift an adversary or a target's behavior to bring it into alignment with your own preferences. But in fact, what we see with the export controls, especially under the Biden administration, and so far under the Trump administration, is that there's really nothing conditional about them. They don't seem to be targeted at shifting China's behavior, getting to improve its human rights record or change its behavior in the South China Sea and so on and so forth. But rather, they're closer to what the international relations theorist Tom Schelling would call brute force, which Schelling says is the undiplomatic, unilateral recourse to violence to degrade the adversary's capabilities. So in that sense, we think they're much closer to warfare than coercion. And the second question is thinking about the scope of the control. So here we can contrast warfare with another concept called strategic embargo, which is developed by a Dartmouth scholar named Mike Massanduno. And the idea behind strategic embargo is you want a very limited strike on military or dual use capabilities, but without the expectation that it is going to significantly affect the target's overall economic wherewithal or well-being. And whereas economic warfare is potentially also about degrading military capabilities, but doing so via degrading broader economic and technological capabilities. And so what I would say is I think the Biden administration officials, hard to say with the second Trump administration so far, but the Biden administration officials, I think, would probably like to insist that their controls are a form of strategic embargo, that they are just meant to target China's military and surveillance capabilities, not its economy overall. And our argument is that that is hard to reconcile with the general purpose nature of the technologies themselves and the fact that military and surveillance applications of these advanced AI technologies account for maybe 5% of the total possible range of applications, the vast majority of which are purely commercial. So if you're constraining China's access to these chips, which are the key inputs into AI technologies, there's really no way that you can do that and effectively enforce those controls without expecting that it's going to significantly degrade China's overall economic well-being or future technological progress. So this is another sense in which we think it's best understood as a form of warfare. It's economic warfare because it's being conducted via controls on flows of capital, goods, and technology between countries. And it's limited because, you know, despite what I just said about the general purpose nature of the technologies, it is in fact the case that so far the U.S. government has been, I would say, very conscientious about trying to keep the scope of its controls limited to a few industrial segments or a few segments of one industrial sector. as opposed to engaging in all-out or unrestricted campaigns of containment like a blockade or an embargo.
You've talked a bit about this already, but I'd love to hear a bit more from you on this. Is that why did the US launch the chip war on China? What was kind of the thinking behind it, and when did it start? And what are some of the direct measures you've talked about, things like strategic embargoes? What did it actually look like in terms of the policy instruments?
So in terms of motives, to try to characterize the US government's motives behind the chip war, in this paper, we draw on a body of literature from the sort of broader research agenda in international relations on the causes of war. And that body of literature is focused on what we could call preventive motivations for war. So we're very much thinking about the chip war in the context of research on the logic behind preventive war. And here, you know, the basic idea from the literature is that war is going to be more likely in the context of large and rapid shifts in the balance of power between a declining dominant power, which in this case would be the US, and a rising challenger, which in this case would be China. And the idea is that in these kinds of situations, dominant but declining powers have very powerful incentives to seize what they see as a closing window of opportunity to prevent future adverse shifts in the balance of power. And so our argument is that this is the basic logic that was motivating the US decision to impose these export controls on China, that American officials were concerned, I think, first and foremost with very rapid advances over the past 15 years in China's capabilities in various forms of high-performance computing, supercomputing, and artificial intelligence. And so that the fundamental goal of the export controls was to take action now, while the US still retained a sizable advantage in these technologies, to ensure that China was not able to close that gap, and to do so by curtailing China's access to critical inputs into these technologies. I will say, though, I think that there are at least two other elements of this story, or two other factors that significantly exacerbated or amplified American officials' concerns. So if we think, you know, the kind of root of this is shifts in capabilities, I think the other two elements here are that there was a simultaneous shift starting, let's say, around 2009, 2010, in American officials' perceptions of China's intentions. And a lot of factors contributed to this. But the net effect of that was that by the middle of the 2010s, and certainly by the first Trump administration, there was an increasingly widespread belief across much of the US foreign policy establishment that China was not a, you know, sort of defensive security seeker, but was rather what IR scholars would call a quote-unquote greedy state, that it harbored malign intentions towards the US and the US-led international order, and that it would seek to proactively revise that order. And I would say the third element that contributed to the motivations from the US, for US officials, again, in particular under the Biden administration, was a growing appreciation for the potentially revolutionary effects of artificial intelligence. Specifically, I think not only the idea that artificial intelligence would revolutionize military affairs as well as economic productivity and the economy more generally, but that the revolution that AI would bring would come sooner than later. So not in 15 years, but in maybe 5 to 10 years. And that AI as a technology would have certain characteristics like other high technology industries, such as high barriers to entry, economies of scale and production, network effects, and so forth, that would make it mean that it didn't diffuse automatically or easily across borders, so that it would be possible to actually control China's access to these and ability to wield these technologies and these capabilities. So I think that those are the three factors, with a primary emphasis on just the sheer growth of China's capabilities and China's broader technological rise that really got the US to impose these controls and to impose them now, as opposed to 10 years ago or 10 years in the future.
So the US-China chip war is an incredibly important issue, and it's very current and it's evolving very quickly. Could you just briefly talk about how you're studying it? How are you getting your hands around it? Who are you speaking to about this?
Yeah, it's a great question because it is evolving so rapidly. You know, things are changing. So I would say for this project that we're working on, the primary evidence that we're relying on so far has been semi-structured interviews with current and primarily former US government officials. So we've spoken with a number of people who worked in various parts of the US government during the Biden administration that were in one way or another involved in the chip export control making process. We've also spoken with a number of former, you know, first Trump administration officials, as well as Obama administration officials, people who were in the Commerce Department and so on and so forth, as well as people from technology firms and industry representatives. So, you know, the basic idea for this project, because we are really focused on pinpointing the motivations and the decision-making process behind the implementation of export controls, with a real focus on the 2022 export controls that the Biden administration introduced that were really focused on constraining China's progress in AI. You know, since our interest is fundamentally the motives behind these decisions, then you know, there's really no better place to go than actually speaking with as many of the people who are involved in it as possible. But we supplement that with a variety of, you know, primary and secondary sources, high-level speech evidence, official U.S. government documents, and then a broad range of commentary from more or less well-connected think tankers, industry experts, and so on and so forth.
So in the media, the U.S. has framed semiconductor trade as a national security issue. What drives this perspective, and does China communicate the topic in the same way? Is the conversation sort of similar there as it is in the U.S.?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things contribute to the evolving framing of semiconductors as a national security issue in the U.S. I'll come to China in a moment. So, you know, one is I do think that there is a certain element of politics in this, which is to say that for better or worse, it is the case that increasingly in a system like the U.S.'s, if you want to mobilize bipartisan support for major legislative actions or to build popular support for executive actions, then it certainly helps to frame issues in terms of national security. That's one way to both, again, mobilize broad support for things across the aisle in Congress, for example, but also to limit the scope, for example, firms and other vested economic interest groups to push back on these kinds of activities, because it's much harder to oppose something that has been successfully redescribed as a security issue instead of a commercial issue. But I think there is a real substance to the increasing emphasis on semiconductors as a national security issue, which again goes back to this idea I talked about before of, you know, if we believe that AI is going to be a revolutionary technology, both for the economy generally, but more specifically for military and intelligence capabilities, then questions of access to and control over these technologies do in fact have very direct implications for national security, or at the very least sort of spillover effects or externalities for security. So it's not surprising in that context that we've over time seen much more emphasis. And I think that this has gone hand in hand with the process by which over the past 8 years or so, U.S. officials came to actually understand what semiconductors are and begin to appreciate the structure of global semiconductor value chains and the role that the U.S. plays in them. I would say on the flip side, it is absolutely the case that China also thinks about technology broadly and semiconductors in particular in terms of national security. And, you know, I spend a lot of time in my research reading through authoritative Chinese central state documents on technology. And one thing I can say is that what comes out very clearly from these documents is that Chinese authorities, I think, are working from a fairly coherent and thoughtful theory of great power politics in which technology, broadly understood, plays a decisive role. So if you see the way that these Chinese government policy documents and quotes from people like Xi Jinping himself describe technology, there is a very intense focus on the idea that technology is the engine of international systemic change, that whoever controls so-called key core technologies will be the dominant power over the next period of time, and so on and so forth. So I think both the U.S. and China are thinking in these directions. And I think that probably there's an interactive effect that as China has begun thinking about these things in terms of national power and security, that's magnified the U.S.'s incentives to do so, which in turn reverberates to how China thinks about them and so on and so forth.
So given your interest in China's global value chains and its influence on international political economy and security, could you briefly talk about how these themes intersect in the current U.S.-China chip war?
Yeah, global value chains have been absolutely central to the story of the U.S.-China chip war, both because I would say both in terms of the U.S.'s decision to launch the chip war on China and also in terms of how that conflict has been conducted so far. I think one very important contributing factor to the decision to go to war, so to speak, in this context, was that, again, as I said, as U.S. policymakers came to understand semiconductors and came to learn more about the structure of global semiconductor value chains, they came to appreciate much better how the U.S., by virtue of its role as really the originator of the semiconductor industry, continues to occupy a very privileged position in semiconductor value chains. An important feature of semiconductor value chains is that they are inherently hierarchical. And this is the case with value chains in any high value add, high technology industry, which is to say that you have at the bottom of the pyramid a number of relatively low value add activities that are relatively easily substitutable, which means if you lose access to one supplier, it's not that hard to find a replacement. But as you go up the division of labor towards higher value add activities, finding replacements for any one existing supplier becomes much harder. And at the apex of these value chains, you have a handful of technologies, perhaps most famously EUV lithography machinery produced by one firm in the Netherlands, that's ASML. You get to the top of these value chains and you've got three or four core technologies which are produced by one, maybe two players globally. And what American policymakers came to realize was that both directly and indirectly, the U.S. had or was in a position to exert legal authority over some of these key, very high value add, very low substitutability products. And that is, in some sense, the definition of a choke point technology. And the implication of that was that American officials became convinced that through their control over these choke point technologies, the U.S. could impose asymmetric costs on China at relatively little cost to the U.S.'s own technological capabilities or economic well-being. And so this gave the U.S. At least the perception of an offensive advantage, which meant it could win the war against China relatively cheaply.
So how has China approached semiconductor technology transfer since the end of the Cold War? And how has the U.S. responded to these efforts?
Yeah, foreign technology transfers have been integral to China's progress in semiconductors, but also the way that China's leaders have thought about technological progress generally and progress in semiconductors in particular. But how China has approached foreign technology acquisition in semiconductors has evolved very dramatically over time. So in the 1990s, China relied primarily on so-called arranged marriage joint ventures between handpicked Chinese companies and handpicked foreign firms. And this approach yielded some benefits, but ultimately was less successful than the Chinese leadership would have wanted for a variety of reasons that I think are particular both to where China's economy was in the 1990s, as well as, I'd say, relatively lower state capacity and institutional wherewithal in the 1990s. Starting in the year 2000, China shifted towards a more laissez-faire approach to semiconductor industrial policy, which really put an emphasis on rapidly integrating China into global semiconductor value chains with an expectation that this would lead through more or less organic means to technological spillovers and industrial upgrading throughout the semiconductor ecosystem in China. And that decision was partly motivated by perhaps ideas or a genuine belief that this would be a good way to upgrade China's semiconductor industry, but also I think was importantly influenced by pushback from foreign chip makers, including firms like TSMC, the Taiwan-based foundry that is now so important to the story of the chip war. Pushback from these companies that did not want to form joint ventures in China because they understood that joint ventures are a potential avenue for leakage of technology to local partner firms. And in the case, these foreign chip makers, I think, were very successful at pushing back against the use of these joint venture requirements and nudging China's leaders in the year 2000 towards a more open and laissez-faire approach to semiconductor industrial policy. As it turned out, I think this had some benefits for the development of China's semiconductor industry, but also in retrospect, probably did hold back their efforts to indigenize part of the value chain precisely because China became deeply enmeshed in semiconductor value chains at the relatively low value add stage of the production chain and didn't really have mechanisms for more actively upgrading the domestic semiconductor capabilities. And so the net effect of this was that throughout the 2000s, although China made some real progress in some cases in semiconductors, broadly speaking, again, in retrospect, they probably fell behind indigenizing certain parts of the supply chain that in a counterfactual world where they had more active policies to promote technology transfer, they might have made more progress. So things then began to change in the 2010s. And this is for a variety of reasons. Some was possibly an actual, say, ideational shift on the part of China's leaders, where they wanted to embrace more active state intervention and more active industrial policy. Some of it was the fact that by the 2010s, China had much greater resources, and it also had a very large and rapidly growing consumer electronics market. And what that meant was that China increasingly in the 2010s found itself in a much stronger bargaining position vis-a-vis foreign firms, because foreign firms were now looking to China not primarily as an offshore export processing hub, so using China to assemble semiconductors into electronics products that got shipped elsewhere, but now actually looking to target the Chinese electronics market. So that gave China a lot more leverage over foreign firms. By the 2010s, China had a lot more capital. And so what we see in the middle of the 2010s is a greater embrace of outward foreign direct investment as a means to acquire technology through mergers and acquisitions of American and Western technology companies. Fast forward to today, I would say that it is absolutely the case that in any part of the semiconductor value chain where China continues to lag the global frontier, technology transfers still matter. Foreign technology still matters. But partly because of increased efforts by the US and other governments to police and monitor the use of more sort of formal and easily measurable forms of technology transfer policy, I think what we've seen is a shifting towards increasingly more difficult to monitor and more indirect means of technology transfer. So rather than things like joint venture requirements or even outward direct investment, I think unsurprisingly, there has been an increased reliance on industrial espionage, cyber espionage, reverse engineering, and so forth.
Semiconductor restrictions by the US, as we've talked about, are aiming to limit China's access to advanced chip manufacturing technology. Can you talk about how effective these measures have been and the extent to which they may have led China to developing their own chip manufacturing industry?
What I would say is so far, these measures have not been very successful overall. But that isn't necessarily because the measures can't succeed. I think a lot of that has to do with what in retrospect is very clearly quite weak enforcement of controls on the books, or simply relatively poor design of controls such that the controls didn't do what US officials initially thought that they would do. And so we have, you know, lots of examples of cases where, for example, the original major package of export controls that the Biden administration introduced in October 2022, you know, they tried to limit China's access to AI chips that had performance power above a certain threshold. But it turned out that NVIDIA, the main US producer of these high-performance GPUs, was able to blow a couple of fuses on an existing chip that lowered the performance of the chips just below the threshold. And over the course of the next year, they shipped hundreds of thousands, if not potentially millions, of these chips to China perfectly legally. And part of that is because it took an entire year for the Biden administration to update their controls, even though officials within the administration understood the problem, you know, probably 3 or 4 weeks after the original package of controls had been put in place. There were other issues with enforcement that, you know, became, I think, especially glaring last year when it was revealed that TSMC had knowingly or perhaps unwittingly manufactured some 3 million artificial intelligence chips for Huawei, which it was Huawei is China's leading technology company and is arguably the single most sanctioned company, technology company in China today, and certainly should not have been able to have any of its chips fabbed by TSMC as of as late as 2024, but they were. So what I would say is that up to date, the controls have probably not been that effective, in part because of these problems with enforcement and the design of the controls themselves. But we haven't really run the experiment yet. So it's entirely possible now that just in the last few months, I think a lot of the outstanding loopholes have been tightened and the Trump administration has signaled its intent to further tighten the loopholes and existing controls, that over the next year or 2 or 3 years, we will see the effects of these controls start to bite. I will say, though, that one other important element of the story is that although in some level the export controls were intended to forestall the indigenization of the semiconductor ecosystem within China, the reality is that prior to the imposition of the export controls, yes, the Chinese government had been throwing tens of billions of dollars at the development of a domestic semiconductor ecosystem. But prior to 2018, 2019, and especially 2022, these policies in China were not very effective. The efforts to grow the semiconductor ecosystem in China were, by most measures, not succeeding. And a big part of that was because there was a fundamental coordination problem within China. So as long as Huawei could have its chips manufactured by TSMC in Taiwan, they had no incentive to work with SMIC, that's China's main domestic foundry. As long as SMIC could buy equipment from ASML, it had no incentive to buy equipment from the Chinese equipment providers, and so on and so forth down the supply chain. So what the export controls did is, by cutting off China's access to these external sources of technology, it resolved that coordination problem for Chinese firms. So Huawei now has no option but to work with SMIC. SMIC has no option but to work with SME or SiCarrier or whatever it may be. And so I do think that as a result of that, it seems to be the case that this has helped to mobilize China to move faster to shift up the division of labor and indigenize parts of the ecosystem. But it remains to be seen whether that will be entirely successful.
So you're currently working on a book called Reinnovation Nation, The Logic of Technology Transfer Policy in China. Could you give our listeners a sneak preview of the book and what it's about?
As I said earlier, the first line of my research is focused on technology transfer and China's use of technology transfer policies to try to secure foreign technology, you know, for the effort of bolstering or promoting its own industrial upgrading, technological indigenization efforts, and so on and so forth. So the real focus of this book project is thinking about how states, in this case China, and firms, in this case foreign multinational corporations investing in China, bargain over the terms of market access and technology transfer. And the idea here is that for developing countries like China, certainly China in the 1990s and in the early 2000s, there really is no way to develop your economy, to shift up the global division of labor, especially in these very high value add, high technology sectors, without gaining broad access to and developing the capacity to really absorb that foreign technology. So technology transfers really matter. But of course, from foreign firms' perspective, although they want access to markets like China, they also want to protect and control their core proprietary technology. So what this project is about is really examining in specific industries, but also broadly across China, the different factors that shape these dynamics of bargaining over when will foreign firms trade technology for market access, or on the contrary, when do foreign firms have sufficient leverage to push back on demands for technology transfer from governments like China. And my interest here is thinking about how things like domestic regulatory institutions within host countries like China, but also variation in the role that a country like China plays in global value chains across different industries, shape those bargaining dynamics. And you know, the goal of this is, although my project is primarily focused on China, the goal is ultimately to shed light on broader dynamics of bargaining over technology between developing countries that need technology and foreign firms that control that technology. And looking forward, one thing I'm really interested in is thinking about, you know, now as we see China moving up that division of labor and becoming an innovator in more and more high technology industries, we also see Chinese firms investing increasingly abroad in building manufacturing capacity in places like Vietnam, parts of Africa, Latin America, and so forth. And so the next thing I'm interested in really looking at, you know, not the dynamics of technology bargaining in terms of technology entering China, but dynamics of bargaining over technology in terms of technology leaving China. And will Chinese firms fall prey to some of the same, we could say, sort of preference misfits that maybe US firms investing in China did in the 1990s and early 2000s?
So we're having this conversation right at the end of March 2025, and the US-China chip war has seemingly faded from the forefront of many people's minds, really, as other global events are taking center stage. Do you think that in the coming months, and maybe even the coming years, public and political focus on the semiconductor industry will resurface? And how do you think President Trump is going to approach this issue going forward?
Yeah, it's funny because for those of us who follow U.S.-China technology relations, it doesn't really feel like it ever left the headlines in the sense that just in the past couple of months, we've had, I would say, two major events that shift the landscape or shape the landscape for U.S.-China tech competition and the export controls more specifically. And the first of those was in early January, as one of its final acts in power, the Biden administration deployed this global AI diffusion framework, which was, you know, a very, very ambitious framework for essentially controlling much of the world's access to US-based compute power and really trying to shape the future of the global division of AI capabilities broadly. And a big part of that was coming up with lists of countries that the US wanted to restrict the sale of these advanced AI chips to ensure that those chips didn't end up in Chinese hands. So we had that development in early January. But then a week later, actually on the day that President Trump was inaugurated in the US, we had the launch of DeepSeek's R1 model, which is very low cost, but highly, highly performant, highly capable AI, large language model AI system. And DeepSeek then raised the prospect that, or the DeepSeek announcement really raised the prospect that perhaps very, very large amounts of compute power would no longer be necessary, because what DeepSeek does is it massively increases the efficiency of the artificial intelligence model in ways that potentially lower or raise the prospect of lowering long-term demand for new compute power. Now, I'd say that is very much contested, and I think the general conclusion is that in fact, DeepSeek and the kind of innovations that it promises or the trend that it indicates pushes towards, in the long run, much more demand for compute power as it promises a more greater democratization or generalization of AI capabilities and AI products. But so say both of these things are still very much at the fore. And I think lurking behind them are these questions of whether and how the US really can control China's access to chips and the compute power that they undergird. In terms of the Trump administration, again, we're speaking towards the end of, at the very end of March 2025. And I will say at this point, it is hard to say exactly what direction the Trump administration is going to go. Already that they have signaled their intention to tighten existing controls, to remove some of the loopholes in current controls, and possibly going forward to expand the scope of controls. And I do think that at the level of, you could say, the national security state, a lot of the people that the Trump administration has appointed into key positions, it does seem to be the case that the administration is quite hawkish on China, and therefore, based on that, we would expect more and tighter controls. So rather than a small yard high fence, which was the Biden administration's formulation, we might see an expansion of the yard while maintaining the fence very high. That said, it's really difficult to say, because a lot will come down to enforcement. And already the Trump administration has signaled that it's going to cut the budget, or even in some cases eliminate outright many of the government agencies and bureaus that are responsible for enforcing these export controls. And I think the uncertainty that that creates is compounded by the fact that President Trump himself has signaled that he wants a quote-unquote deal with China. And we don't know at this point what the terms of such a deal might be, but certainly I would say very high up on the Chinese side's list of demands would be either the removal or some kind of relaxation of these export controls. But all of this being said, I think, you know, insofar as geopolitical competition between the US and China is here to stay, and insofar as technology remains a key domain of that competition, it seems very unlikely that we're going to see a broad and sustained shift away from the current trajectory. But it's very uncertain times, so we don't know exactly where things are going to go.
And just before we finish, I'd just like to invite you to direct our listeners' attention to any new projects or work you've got coming up, or anything else you think our listeners would be interested in.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I can speak about a couple of projects I'm currently working on. So as I talked about my book project, and I have two articles that are based on that, which are, you know, in various states of completion and hopefully will be in publication in the not too distant future. I'm also working on the paper that the talk I gave at the Phelan Center is based on, which is on the origins of the US-China chip war. And I've got other work that's looking at thinking about this idea of weaponized interdependence, which is a sort of very popular term for describing a lot of what the US has been doing, and China to some extent has been doing, in terms of weaponizing these economic networks of interdependence for statecraft purposes. And the project I'm working on is thinking about the conditions under which the network centrality, the network position that makes the weaponization of these networks feasible, might degrade over time. Those are my current projects I'm working on. In terms of other research that I would direct people's attention to, I would highlight a really fantastic piece that's been really formative in my own thinking about US-China technology competition by Chen Ling and Miles Evers, which is called Wars Without Gunsmoke. It was published in International Security in 2023. And more broadly, I would highlight the work of Yeling Tan, who doesn't write on export controls per se, but wrote a really superb book called Disaggregating China, Inc. that came out a few years ago, which tries to very closely examine and explain dynamics of the sort of the response to WTO accession in 2001 across different parts of the Chinese state. And I think provides one of the best accounts I've read recently about the making of economic policy and the political economy of contemporary China.
Well, I'm sure our listeners will be looking out for your upcoming projects, and we'll also link to the other resources you mentioned in our show notes, including an interview with Yeling Tan that we did recently. It just remains for me to say, Professor John Minnick, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark.
Thank you for having me.
John Minnick is an assistant professor in the Department of International Relations at LSE. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks so much to Dr. John Minnick for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Luke Digweed. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US. And tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or of the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.